Hi, this is Thelma English, and I'm going to be reading to you from Book 12 of the Robert Fitzgerald translation of Virgil's Aeneid. So grab your copy of Virgil's Aeneid, the Robert Fitzgerald translation. You need to follow along in your book. And this is Book 12, the finale. Turnus now saw how Latin, those are his own Italian people, how their strength had failed, how the day's fight was lost and they were broken, saw that they held him to his promise now, all eyes upon him. But before they spoke, his passion rose, hot and unquenchable. So he's getting angry. What was it like as he got angry? As in the African hinterland, a lion, hit in the chest by hunters, badly hurt, gives battle then at last and revels in it, tossing his bunch of mane back from his nape, all fighting hard. He snaps the shaft the tracker puts into him and roars with bloody maw. So Turnus is just like a big, angry, injured, wounded lion. So Turnus in the extremity flared up and stormed at the old king, King Latinus. No one waits while Turnus shirks a battle. No pretext allows Aeneas's riffraff to renege or take their challenge back. By God, I'll fight him. Father, bring sacred offerings and state the terms of combat. Either by this right arm, I send to hell that Dardan prince, Trojan prince, who left his Asia, Troy, in the lurch, and let the Latins rest and look on, while I alone disprove, with my sword point, the charge against us all, or else let him take over a beaten people. Let Lavinia be the winner's bride. So now Turnus wants to do a one-on-one combat with Aeneas, and whoever wins gets to marry Lavinia. To this, Latinus answered steadily. So this is King Latinus to Turnus. Soldier without a peer, as you surpass the rest in heroism, all the more must I labor to think and weigh my fears, taking account of all that may occur. To have your father Daunus's realm, you have your many conquered towns. Gold and the heart to spend it are not lacking in Latinus. Here in Latium, or in the Laurentine land, are other girls of noble blood unmarried. Okay, there's other girls. Allow me these reflections. Painful, yes, but open and above board. Take to heart this fact. It was not right that I should pledge my daughter to a suitor of other days. Gods and prophecies of men forbade. Affection for you, our Rutulian kinsman, won me over, and my wife in tears. I broke my bonds of duty, stole a girl, though promised, from her husband, and took arms against the will of heaven. Line 45. So King Latium is saying, I shouldn't have given my daughter away to you. I should have done what the gods wanted me to do with her. I took her against the will of heaven. You have seen what followed, Turnus, the bloody wars and the defeats, the bitter days you most of all endure. Between in two great battles, barely alive, we keep Italian hopes within our town. With Tiber's currents, warm still with our blood, the open land, white with our bones. And why again and yet again am I pulled back from action? What mad dream blurs my resolve? Granted, with Turnus dead, I am prepared to make them partners in the realm. So granted, if you die, I'm going to have to make them partners in the realm. Why not stop fighting, rather, while he lives unharmed? So why don't we just stop it so you don't get killed? What will Rutulians of your family say? What will all Italy say if I betray you? Heaven forbid, to death, while you contend for marriage to my daughter. Line 60. Only give thought to the veering ways of war. Take pity on your aged father, whom Ardea keeps at home, secluded from us and forlorn. All that he said affected Turnus's fury. Not in the least. It mounted all the more, fevered at words of healing. And when the man could speak at all, he said, now this is Turnus replying to King Latinus, my lord, I beg you, put this reckoning for my sake aside for my sake. Let me bid my death for honor. Father, I too can make a rapid cast of javelins, not puny when they strike. Blood flows from wounds I too can give. This time his mother goddess, Venus, she who when he runs hides him in womanish cloud, who hides herself in empty phantoms, she'll be far away, like what Venus did at Troy. But now the queen, Amata, terrified by the new hazard of the single combat, wept and pale as death clung to her ardent son-in-law. So this is Queen Amata to Turnus, because Aeneas, of course, is a demigod. She doesn't want Turnus to fight him. Turnus, I beg you by these tears, by all you hold at heart for me, Amata, your own one hope, our stay in grim old age. Latinus's honor and authority rest in your hands. All our declining house now leans upon you. This one thing I beg, refrain from single combat with the Trojans. Any mischance that may await you there awaits me too, for with you I'll forsake this hostile daylight. Never as a captive shall I look on Aeneas as my son. Lavinia, listening to her mother, so this is the girl who's being argued about, listening to her mother, streamed with tears on burning cheeks. a deepening blush brought out by a fiery glow on her hot face. So what is it like as she blushes? As when one puts a stain of crimson dye on ivory of India, or when white lilies blush infused with crimson roses. So rich the contrast in her coloring seemed. Desire stung the young man as he gazed, rapt at the girl, so he can't quit staring at her. She's so beautiful. He burned yet more for battle, Brent briefly answering Amata. So now Turnus returns in reply to Queen Amata, "Please, mother, no tears for me, like mother, my mother-in-law-to-be. No parting omen so unpromising as I go out to combat, ruled by Iron Mars. No longer is Turnus free to put off risk of death. Edmund, come, be my messenger. Say this to the Phrygian tyrant, the Trojan Aeneas, words not to his liking. When dawn tomorrow, born from the ocean stream on crimson chariot wheels, reddens the sky, he need not lead the Trojans in attack on the Rutulians. Let all Trojan weapons rest. Rutulians rest with our own blood. Let us too put an end to war. And there on that field, let Lavinia be the prize." Line 116. With this, he whirled away into his quarters, called for his team, and smiled with joy at horses whinnying before him. These were the two that Erythia, consort of the North Wind, gave as a glory to Pelumnus, horses rivaling snow in whiteness, wind in speed, and flanking them, the nimble charioteers clapped hollow palms to chests and combed their manes. Then round his shoulders, Turnus donned his cuirass, his breastplate of armor, glinting with golden and pale copper scales, made ready sword and shield and helm with horns to bear his crimson plume. The sword was one the fire god himself had forged for Daunus. So the fire god, of course, is Hephi or Vulcan or Mulciber, whatever you want to call him, that he had forged for Daunus, that's Turnus's father, dipping it white hot in the wave of Styx, okay, the river Styx from the underworld. And finally, from where it leaned against a pillar in the hall, he picked a spear, his powerful hand gripping that hardy shaft he took in battle from a Runcan actor. Shaking it and making it vibrate, he cried out, so this is Turnus, "The spear that never failed me once when called on, now the time has come. A champion once carried you, Turnus bears you now. See to it that I smash down that body and tear away with my strong hand the breastplate of the Phrygian eunuch." So that's like saying the Trojan eunuch. The equivalent today would be saying to hand the, with my strong hand, the breastplate of that Trojan woman. He's trying to call Aeneas anything horrible. "And befoul in dust those lovelocks, curled with hot iron, drenched with liquid myrrh." So he's calling Aeneas a sissy boy. To this length, driven by passion, he gave off a sparkling glow from his whole face, and fire flashed from his eyes. And what was it like? As a wild bull at bay will give a fearsome bellow and wet his horns to fury on a tree trunk, striking blows against the wind, kicking up spurts of sand in prelude to the fight. So that's what it was like. "Likewise, meanwhile, Aeneas." So now back to Aeneas. "Meanwhile, back to Aeneas, fierce in his maternal love, in his maternal armor." So his armor from Venus whetted his edge for war and roused himself to anger, full of joy that by the terms he offered, war should cease. He comforted his officers, allayed pale Iulius's fear, so his son Ascanius, recalling fate's design, then ordered men to take Latinus an assured reply and set conditions for the coming peace. So he's assured by the gods. He's positive he's going to win. The next day's dawn had barely cast its glow on mountaintops at that hour when the sun's heaven-climbing team strives from the deep, exhaling light from the flaring nostrils. Remember the Parthenon scene where dawn is brought up by a chariot of snorting horses. From flaring nostrils, when Rutulian troops and Trojans under the city walls laid out a field for combat. Some built hearths and grassy altars for their common gods, while fire and fresh spring water were brought out by priests in cloaks, rosemary round their brows. The compact legion of Ausonians debouched now from the crowded city gates. So it means to debouch is to come pressing right out of the gates, almost like a bottleneck, you know, all pressing through at the same time, debouched now from the crowded city gates. The Trojan Tuscan army from the plain streamed up in various accoutrement, ranks glinting steel as though rough work of Mars had called them, and amid their numbers, captains wheeled about in pride of gold and crimson, Mnestheus of Acarsus's line, valiant Achilles, and the master of horse, Messapus, Neptune's son. At a trumpet note, each side retired to its appointed zone, with lances fixed in earth and shields at rest. So they're all getting ready for this one-on-one combat on opposite sides. Then matrons and townspeople, pouring out with old men and infirm, thronged towers and roofs, while others clustered at the tall gateways. But gazing from the height we now call Alban, so in Virgil's time they call Alban, a nameless then, it had no fame or glory. So this is the fame or glory of it, because this is where Aeneas won against Turnus. So in Virgil's time, 1,000 years later, it's a place of fame and glory. Juno surveyed the plain. So Hera is looking all around to see the facing lines, Troy's and Laurentum's, and Latinus's town. Promptly she turned immortal to immortal and spoke to Turnus's sister, the nymph of the ponds. So Turnus has a sister who's a nymph, and her name is Juturna. They'll bring up her name later. Nymph of ponds and purling streams, heaven's King Jupiter, for the maidenhead that he had ravished, gave this divine dignity, rule over limpid things. So now Juno speaks to Juturna, who is Turnus's sister, and basically she says, you better go help your brother Turnus down there. Nymph, she said, and loveliness of rivers, cherished by me, you know I honor you above all Latin girls who ever entered great Jove's unwelcome bed. So, you know, I know all about that you were Jove's girlfriend. I know that he made you a nymph, you know, as a divine privilege and all that. But you're my favorite of all my husband's boyfriends, is basically what she just said. Great-hearted Jove's unwelcome bed, I've kept most happily for you a place in heaven. And now let me tell you of your grief to be, lest you think me the cause. A while fortune seemed compliant, and the fates let power rest with Latium, your brother, Turnus, and your city had my protection. Now I see the soldier meeting a destiny beyond his strength. His doomsday, mortal shock of the enemy, are now at hand. I cannot bear to watch this duel, this pact. If you dare help your brother more at close quarters, do it, and well done. A better time may follow present pain. The words were barely out before Juturna's eyes brimmed with tears. With her clenched hand, she thrice or four times beat her comely breast. This is no time for tears, the goddess said. Be quick, go snatch your brother back from death if there's a way, or else renew the war. Cast out the pact, which they drew up. I'll be sponsor to your audacity. So Juno will support her. You go down, break it up so they don't have the single combat, because then Turnus will die immediately. Go break their compact of peace. Make them all fight with each other. And Juno says, I'll support you. Line 215. With this last urgent word, she left her wondering, torn in turmoil from the pang her heart had suffered. Meanwhile, the kingly men appeared, Latinus mighty in aspect, in a four-horse chariot, his shining brow crowned with 12 golden rays in token of the sun, his ancestor, while Turnus rode behind his snowy team, handling a pair of spears broad in the blade. Then from his quarters, Lord Aeneas came, the father of the Roman race, aglow with starry shield and armor forged by heaven. Close at his side, the second hope of Rome, Ascanius, little Iulius, a priest in a clean robe, brought out a boar's young and a sheep unshorn to place before the altar fires. These men, with eyes turned to the rising sun, bestowed their handfuls of salt meal, took knives to mark the forehead of the beast, and poured from shallow ritual cups libations on the altars. Aeneas, line 235, the God-fearing, with drawn sword, spoke out his vows. Son, be my witness now, and for this land, for whose sake I could endure hard days and many, then the Almighty Father also, and this lady, thou, Saturnia, this is the daughter of Saturn, which would be to you Juno, he's trying to make amends to Juno, thou, Saturnia, Juno, more kindly to us, goddess, now I pray, and thou too, famous Mars, whose hand hurls down on men all wars according to thy will, I call on springs and streams, and all the powers both of high heaven and the deep blue sea. Should victory fall to the Ausonian Turnus, it is agreed that in defeat we shall retire upon Evander's town, that Iulius quit this region, and Aeneas's people never afterward return in war, or send this kingdom challenges to arms. If, on the other hand, the day is ours, conferred by divine victory, as I think, and may the gods confirm it by their will, I shall not make Italian underlings to Trojans. For myself, I ask no kingdom. Let both nations, both unconquered, both subject to equal laws, commit themselves to an eternal union. I shall give rituals and gods to both. My father-in-law Latinus, let him keep his arms and keep his royal authority. My share will be a town with walls laid out and built by Trojans. Lavinia will give that town her name. So it's going to be called Lavinium. So if he wins, then Aeneas says, If I lose, my son and all our people will leave and will never come back and will never try and fight you. If Aeneas wins, then he's just going to live side by side with his people. They won't be his slaves or anything like that. Line 265. In these terms, first, Aeneas declared himself. Latinus followed with a skyward look, his right hand lifted to the stars. So King Linnaeus is speaking to Aeneas. King Latinus is speaking to Aeneas. Aeneas, I swear by the same powers, by earth and sea and stars, by the twin children of Latona, another name for Leto, so that would be by Apollos and Artemis, or Diana. Janus's two faces, and the nether powers, shrines of pitiless Dis of Vulcan. Let this be heard by the Sky Father, who with lightning bolts, that would be Zeus Jupiter, can seal inviolate the pacts of men. Here, as I touch the altars, I appeal to ritual fires and mediating gods. Never shall that day dawn that sees our peace, our treaty, ruptured by my countrymen, however things fall out. No force on earth can make me swerve from my intent. No force, though it embroil the earth and water and flood, to pour land into sea, heaven into hell, just as this scepter here in my right hand will never put out foliage or shade. Once cut from the live tree bole in the forest, torn from that mother and laid bare by steel of branching arms and leaves, this one-time bough the artificer's hand has fitted well in a bronze sheath and given to our Latin lords to carry. By these spoken vows, they sealed the pact between them in the sight of captains on both sides, then cut the throats of duly hallowed beasts over the flames and tore the living entrails out to heap in freshly loaded platters on the altars. On the Rutulian side, the coming match seemed more unfair, however, as time went on. When, seeing the contenders close at hand, they saw their strength unequal. So now that everybody's looking, they can tell that Aeneas, obviously, is much, much stronger than Turnus. He is a demigod, after all. This disquiet multiplied now as Turnus walked in silence, reverently and humbly, to the altars, eyes downcast, his cheeks drawn, his flesh pale. Now when Juturna, Turnus' sister, saw troops in commotion, whispering ever louder, and losing heart, she moved into the ranks, disguised as Camers, an officer whose ancestry was noble, his father's valor a matter of renown, and he himself assiduous in arms. Taking this form, so his sister is disguised, amid the ranks she went, aware of their condition, putting out one rumor and another, asking them, "Does not one blush, Rutulians, to expose one life, one soldier, for so large a force? In numbers of good men in fighting power, are we no match for them? Look, all are here, Trojans, Arcadians, fate-driven Tuscans, foes to Turnus. If we take them on with merely every other man, we barely find a foe for each. Turnus, so we outnumber them, Turnus will rise in fame to those high gods upon whose altars he makes the offering of his life. He'll be alive upon the lips of men. Not so with all the rest. Losing our fatherland, proud masters on our backs, will be enslaved for never stirring on this field today." This fueled the fire of what the soldiers thought, and louder murmuring crept through the ranks. Laurentine, too, and Latin, their mood changed, and men who lately hoped for rest from combat, safely for their way of life, now fell to hankering for weapons, wished the pact could be unmade, and pitied Turnus's lot as underdog, line 335. To add to all this, then, Juturna, Turnus's sister, gave a more insidious stroke, for high in heaven she produced a sign most potent to confuse Italian minds, a strange, deceitful tableau, winging down through rosy, dawnlit air. Jove's golden bird, an eagle, came chasing offshore seafowl, noisy fox, and with a swoop upon the waves, caught up in crooked talons, a surpassing swan. The Italians gazed enthralled. Then all the birds in flight wheeled around with screams, wondrous to see, their wings darkening heaven and in a cloud, harrying the enemy through the air until their pressure and the swan's weight broke his grip. His talons dropped his prey into the river. Then, gaining depth of cloud, he soared away. Cheers at this omen broke from the Rutulian ranks. So this omen that Juturna was able to create, an eagle chasing away all of these flocks of birds, in their mind is a sign from Jove, or Zeus, that they will be able to chase away Aeneas and all his men. Cheers at this omen broke from the Rutulian ranks, and hands were freed for arms. Tolumnius, the augur, so this is their seer or their prophet, gave a try. Here was the sign I often looked for in my prayers. I welcome it. I see the gods behind it. And remember, it's really just Juturnius tricking them. Juturna. Turnus's sister tricking them. I welcome it. I see the gods behind it. Arm with me. Follow my lead, poor countrymen, on whom that vulture from abroad has come to scare like light wind terms or gulls in war and to lay waste our seaboard. He'll be gone, his canvas wide-winged, toward horizon cloud. It is for you to take heart altogether. Close your formations and fight on to save the prince this raiding stranger took for prey. So Telumnius is, who is their seer or their prophet, he's going to break the truce. He finished, then ran forward with a spear to launch it at the facing enemy, the whistling shaft of Cornel sang ahead, unwavering through the air. At the same time, a great shout sounded from all companies, their hearts grown hot with turmoil, as the spear flew on toward nine handsome brothers stood, all of them born to the Arcadian, Galypsus by his faithful Tuscan wife. The spear hit one of them, just at the waist, where the sewn belt rubbed on it his upper belly, and a brooch clamped the strap from either side. The spear that passed from rib to rib brought down this well-built soldier, all agleam in armor, pitching him in the tawny sand. His brothers, brave men, now as one in shock and grief, line 381, some with swords out, some with steel to throw, came in a blind rush forward, but Laurentine squads moved out to meet them double quick. Then from the other side again came Trojans, Tuscans from Agila, Arcadians in painted gear, now charging side by side. One passion took possession of all, to make the sword their arbiter. So they're going to let, an arbiter is one who speaks for you, so they're going to let their sword speak for them. They ripped the altars to get firebrands. Missiles flew in darkening squalls over the whole sky, a rain of steel, while sacrificial bowls and hearth fires of the peace were snatched away. His treaty void, Latinus took to flight with images of his defeated gods. So this is kind of sad. King Latinus kind of runs away from the battle with his gods. Line 395. Others caught up their chariot reins or vaulted into the saddle, drawing blades, advancing, avid to break the pact. Messapus rode against Aletes, the Etruscan prince who wore a prince's blazon. This poor captain flinched aside, then stumbled as he whirled amid the obstructing altars and went down on head and shoulders. In a flash, Messapus rode up with his spear high on his horse, and even as the prone man begged for mercy, thrust hard downward with his beam-like shaft. Then he called out, "That does for him a richer carcass for the great gods." This word looks like a carcase. It's the same word as carcass, just an older form of it. For the great gods. So he says, you know, here's a body and he landed almost amid the embers. So here's a sacrifice, this person. And Italians running up despoiled the still warm body. Out of one altar, Cornelius pulled a half-burnt firebrand, facing Ebesius as he came lunging for a stroke. He hit him between the eyes with flames. His bush of beard flared up and gave a smell of burning flesh. Corineus closed and caught in his left hand his staggered enemy's hair, then struck a knee into his groin and bent him to the ground to be dispatched with a sword thrust in the side. With naked blade, line 420, Podalirius rose behind the shepherd Alsus as he ran along the front through spears, but Alsus whirled his axe backward and split the skull of his enemy from brow to chin. Gore spattered on his armor, harsh repose oppressing his eyes, a sleep of iron, and in eternal night they closed. Meanwhile, the man of honor, Aeneas, stood bareheaded with his right hand out, unarmed, and called his troops. "Where bound? Are you a mob? Why this outbreak of brawling all at once? Cool your hot heads. A pact has been agreed to. Terms have been laid down. I am the one to fight them. Let me do so. Never fear. With this right hand, I'll carry out the treaty. Turnus is mine. Our sacrifice obliged it." But even as he called out, as he spoke, a winging shaft, look, whizzed and struck the man. That's Aeneas. Sped by who knows what hand. What spinning gust, what stroke of luck, what god won this distinction for the Rutulians. Glory for the shot when afterwards suppressed. No claims were made by anyone of having hit Aeneas. So somebody hit Aeneas. When Turnus saw Aeneas in retreat, line 445, leaving his troops and saw the Trojan captains thrown in disarray, he seethed again with sudden hope and called for team and weapons. Flashing aboard his car, his chariot, in one proud leap, he pulled hard at the reins and went careering, handing over to death dozens of men and bringing others down half dead. Whole files he smashed under his wheels. He wrested spears from men who fled and killed them on the run. Like blood-stained Mars himself he rode. What was it like? as when Mars goes headlong by the frozen Hebrus River, beating out claps of thunder on his shield and lashing on his furious team for war, that team that on the open ground outruns the south and west winds, while the farthest land of Thrace, where all the bad people are from, re-echoes to their drumming hooves, and riding with him go black visages of affright, ambush, and anger, Mars's companions. That was the way of Turnus. So Turnus doing, slashing down people right and left, killing and maiming, is just like the god Mars. This is probably his Aristeia in the book. Lashing on a team that smoked with sweat amid the battle, trampling foes in wretchedness brought down. His running hooves kicked up a bloody spray and pocked the mire of sand and gore. The rider cut down Sthenelus with a long throw, Thamyrus, and then Pholus at close quarters. With a long throw again, Imbrasius' sons, Glaucus and Laides, whom their father reared in Lycia and richly fitted to fight on foot or to outride the wind. Elsewhere in the field, Eumedes charged into the melee, a man famed for war, son of the fabled Dolon, having his name from his old grandfather, his recklessness and deft hand from his father, who had dared to ask Achilles' team as his reward. Do you remember back in the Iliad book team, book 10? Iliad book 10, Dolon had requested, he said he would go spy on them, but he wanted Achilles' horses in return, and of course he was asking too much because he was mortal and the horses are immortal, and so, you know, he's the one that they tied up and said, you'll be okay, and then they slashed his throat. So his grandfather was that man who had dared to ask Achilles' team of horses as his reward for spying upon the Dardan camp at Troy. For that audacity, Diomedes gave a different reward. All hope expired for horses of Achilles. Now when Turnus caught sight of Eumedes at a distance across the plain, he had a shot at him with a light javelin over the open space, drove after it, reined in, and vaulted down to where the man had fallen and lay dying. With one foot on his neck, he wrenched away the sword from his right hand, then sank the blade, shining, but soon encrimsoned in his throat. Then from above he said, so this is Turnus boasting, here's a good land, Trojan. So he's saying to this guy he's killing, Trojan, the western land you thought to take in war, lie there and measure it. See what is gained by daring to face up to me in arms. See how far you go in founding cities. To bear him company, he brought Abistes down with a spear cast, then killed Choreses, Sybaris, Dares, and Thersuros. Diomedes, too, thrown what when his horse shied. What was all this like? As Thracian, and of course from Thrace, that's where I think the Amazons come from, all the really violent people, it's dedicated to Mars or Ares. As Thracian Northwind Boreas in a gale roars on Aegean deeps and shoreward surf where squalls roll down the dark and the scud flies, just so, wherever Turnus cut his way, formations yielded to him, ranks turned tail and ran before him. His own impetus carried him on, the wind his chariot made whipped back and forth his flying crest. One man, Phegeus, hated the sight of Turnus tall before him thundering on. Square in the chariot's path, he flung himself and yanked aside the galloping horse's jaws that foamed upon the bits. While he hung on to the yoke, line 515, borne onward, Turnus's broad spearhead, now thrust at his unshielded flank, broke through his mail of double mesh and grazed his body. Nonetheless, turning his shield around, resorting to his blade, he made a lunge, only to go down headlong as the wheel and axle, spinning, struck and laid him low. Then, by a stroke between the helmet rim and breastplate, Turnus cut his head away, leaving his trunk mired in the sand. All right, meanwhile, line 525, meanwhile, we're going to go back to Aeneas now. While all these deaths were being brought about by Turnus, Mnestheus and Achates, ever faithful, accompanied by Ascanius, helped Aeneas into the camp, bleeding, put his weight with every other step on his long spear. He strove in rage to extract the arrowhead with snapped-off shaft and asked for the quickest way, a sword cut, making a deeper and opened wound to expose the embedded point, then send him back into the battle. But now Iapis came, son of Iasus and most dear to Phoebus, to Apollo. Captured one time by sharp desire, Apollo made him gifts of skills that were the gods, augury, and the lyre and speeding arrows. Iapix, however, to postpone the death of a father desperately ill, preferred to learn the powers of herbs, a healer's ways, and practice without glory silent arts. Aeneas, bitterly impatient, stood and leaned on his great spear, unmoved by tears of soldiers gathering in a crowd, and Iulus, his son, grieving. In Paean style, the old man rolled his cloak back carefully and worked with his physician's hand, with herbs of potency from Phoebus Apollo, all in vain trying to worry out the barb or grip and tug the embedded steel with tongs. So Aeneas is standing there the whole time, leaning on a spear while they're trying to rip this thing out of one of his ribs. No luck guided his probes, and no help came from Phoebus Apollo, the arch-healer. More and more savage the terror of the field grew. Nearer came the calamitous end. By now they saw a wall of dust that stood against the sky, horsemen approaching, arrows falling thick into the middle of the camp, and skyward rose the shouts of men who fought, the cries of men who fell, cut down by pitiless Mars. Now, shaken by the pain unmerited her son bore, so now we're going to hear the thoughts and words of Venus, Aphrodite, because she loves Aeneas, he's her son. Now, shaken by the pain unmerited, her son bore, Mother Venus, picked a stalk of dittany from Cretan Ida, dittany with downy leaves and scarlet flower, a plant that wild goats know about when struck with arrows. Venus now brought this down, veiling her face in a dark cloud, and for a secret poultice dipped the leaves to imbue a shining bowl of Tiber water, sprinkling in ambrosias, health-giving juices, and the fragrant heal-all. So ambrosia from the gods. She's putting that on Aeneas's wound. Health-giving juices and the fragrant heal all. Quite unaware of her, old Iapis used the medicated fluid to lave, to wash the wound. Then, sure enough, all anguish instantly left Aeneas's body. All his bleeding, line 576, stopped. Deep in the wound, the arrowhead came out, unforced and ready to his hand. New strength renewed his old-time fighting spirit. "Here, be quick, and give the man his armor," Iapix exclaimed. "Why stand there?" First to speak, he fired their hearts against the enemy. "No mortal agency brought this about. No art, however skilled, not on my own hand preserves you, but a greater power, Aeneas. A god is here at work. He sends you back to greater actions." Avid for battle now, so now we're going back to Turnus. Avid for battle now, the captain sheathed his left leg and his right in golden greaves, hating the minutes lost, and hefted his long spear. Once he had fitted shield to flank, harness to back, he hugged Ascanius, embracing him with steel. So this is not Turnus. Excuse me, this is Aeneas, putting on his armor again. Hugging Ascanius, his son, embracing him with steel, then through his visor, brushed his lips, and said, "Learn fortitude and toil from me, my son. Ache of true toil. Good fortune learn from others. So I'm not lucky. You can learn fortitude and toil, how to work hard and how to be good, but you're going to have to learn good luck from others because I don't have any good luck. My sword arm now will be your shield in battle and introduce you to the boons of war. When before long you come to man's estate, be sure that you recall this. Harking back for models in your family, let your father, Aeneas, and Uncle Hector stir your heart, because Aeneas and Hector are cousins." This said, his powerful figure passed the gates, his long spear flashing in his hand. With him, Antheus and Menestheus and a dense battalion sortied en masse, and all the reserves inside flowed outward from the abandoned camp. The field went dark with blinding dust. The marching feet awakened, crumbled earth, and made it tremble. Line 6:10. Turnus, from the rampart opposite, saw them coming. So did the Ausonians, and felt a chill of dread run through their bones. First of them all to hear and know the sound, Juturna. So Turnus' sister Juturna is thinking, oh no, Aeneas is back. Juturna trembled and turned back. Aeneas, with flying feet, led through the open field, his dark battalion at a high speed. What was it like? As when a storm cloud out to sea moves toward the land and cuts the sunlight off, then farmers know, alas, what's coming, shivering in their hearts, for it will bring down trees, devastate crops, and flatten all things far and wide. The winds fly in ahead and bring the tempest roar. So just like when poor farmers look out because a storm's coming, just so the captain from the Troy led his, that's Aeneas, led his troops in close formation, swarming on against the enemy. With his long blade, Thambrius cut massive Osiris down. Menestheus killed Arsetius. Epulu fell to Achates. Ufens fell to Gaius. Telumnus, the augur, too, succumbed. He who had made that first spear cast against them. So the guy that broke the truce just got killed. Skyward, the shouting rose as in their turn. Rutulians turned to their dusty backs and fled across the fields. Aeneas held aloof from fugitives and would not chase or kill those met on foot or mounted men with lances. So Aeneas is very gracious in battle. He's on a horse and he refuses to kill people who are not also on a horse. So he's in very contrast to Turnus, who just mowed everybody down, remember? So Aeneas here, he's wonderful. Though he refused to chase or kill those met on foot or mounted men with lances. In the dense murk, he tracked Turnus alone, called on Turnus alone to stand and fight him. Stricken with dread of this, Juturna, Turnus's sister, now nerved as a man for combat, made Metisius, Turnus's charioteer, tumble head first along the reins and fall from the chariot pole. So Juturna, Turnus's sister, just made his chariot driver fall out of the chariot kind of silently so Turnus wouldn't know. And she goes in, she's going to be her own brother's chariot driver, but he's supposed to think she's still that guy. Then she left him far behind as she drove onward, swerving, reins in hand, and took the entire guise, voice, and armor of Metiscus. What was it like? Line 645. About a rich landowner's farm, a black-winged swallow flits in lofty rooms and picks up a meal of scraps and crumbs for her loud nestlings. Now she is heard in empty colonnades, now skimming over ponds. Just so Juturna, borne by that team amid her enemies, in her swift car chariot, traversed the field, now here, now there. She showed her brother glorying and would not let him fight, but flew far onward. She's trying to keep him safe. Aeneas, all the same, kept after him, line 655, following his twists and turns, and calling out in a loud voice among the scattered troops. But each time that he glimpsed his enemy and tried to match on foot the speed and flight of the racing team, Juturna whirled away. He groaned. What could he do? As in a cross-rip weltering without headway, in his heart he felt desires clash. But now against him Messapus came, light on his feet, with two steel-pointed and tough spears in his left hand. He twirled and threw one, aimed for a direct hit, and halting, falling to one knee, Aeneas crouched behind his shield. The driven spear still carried off the apex of his helm and knocked away his plume. At this attack, a tide of battle fury swept the Trojan, overcome by Rutulian bad faith. The team and car of his great adversary being out of range, he called on Jove and called on altars of the broken peace to witness many times. Then into the melee he raced, most terrible to see, with Mars behind him, rousing blind and savage slaughter, all restraints on wrath cast to the winds. So Aeneas tried to just go fight Turnus and not kill everybody else. But he finally kind of got knocked down, and he had to, so he's appealing to Mars to help him. He's got to fight. Line 680, so he calls to Mars. What god can help me tell so dread a story? Who could describe that carnage in a song? The captains driven over the plain and killed by Turnus, or in turn by Troy's great hero Aeneas. Was it thy pleasure, Jupiter, that peoples afterward to live in lasting peace should rend each other in so black a storm? One duel briefly stayed the Trojan charge when Sucro, the Rutulian, held Aeneas. Then on that side, where fate is quickest, Aeneas drove his raw steel through the man's ribcage. Turnus unhorsed Amycus and his brother Diores, dismounted then to strike them, killing with his spear the one who came against him, and the other with his sword. He cut their heads away and bore them off, dripping blood, hung to his chariot rail. Aeneas consigned Talus and Tenaeus to bloody death, and now Sicarius, three in one fight. Then Aeetes, as he mourned them, a son of Perdia from fabled Thebes. Turnus killed certain brothers sent from Lycia, Apollo's highlands, and went on to kill Menoetes, hater of war, his hatred vain. A fisherman in his Acadian youth, he had his poor hut near the brooks of Lerna, crowded with perch, and knew no seats of power. His father tilled a plot of rented land, so he's a poor man. The two assailants were like fires begun on two sides of a dry wood, making laurel thickets crackle, or like snow-fed streams that foam and roar seaward down mountainsides, and leave each one a watercourse laid waste. With no less devastating power, these two, Aeneas and Turnus, cut their way through battle. Now with fury rising, now again with bursting hearts and reckless of defeat, they spent their whole strength running upon danger. Here came Murranus, and he boasted loud of grandfathers and grandfathers of theirs, of old names, and one family entire that came down through the Latin kings. Aeneas tumbled him headlong with a whirlwind cast of a big stone and bashed him to the ground. Under the yoke and reins, his own wheels knocked him rolling, where with beating hooves his team, oblivious of their master, trampled him. Then Hylas charged ahead in boundless rage, but Turnus met him with a javelin flung against his gilded brow, and through his helm the shaft stuck in his brain. Bravest of Greeks, Cretheus, neither could you, by your sword-arm, be saved from Turnus, nor when Aeneas came did gods protect their minister, Capuncus. Their minister, Capuncus, line 735. Facing the blade thrust at his breast, he could not fend it with his brazen shield. Poor soldier. Then the Laurentine fields witnessed your death, Aeolus. Yours, too, sprawled on the earth, whom once the Argive columns and Achilles, bane of Priam's realm, could not bring down. Here was your finish. Though your manor stood in Ida's shade, your manor, Lysimus, Laurentine earth, would be your sepulchre, grave. So even though your manor is in a beautiful place, your grave's right here. Each army's total strength was now engaged. Line 745. All Latins and all Trojans, every man, Mnestheus and brave Serestus too, Messapus, master of horse, valiant Asilas, ranks of Tuscans and Arcadians of Evander, each putting all he had into the struggle. Never a let-up, never a breathing spell. In the vast combat, every man fought on. Here, though, Aeneas' lovely mother, Venus, sent the captain a new thought. So Venus sends Aeneas a thought. To approach the walls, to bring his troops to bear upon the city quickly, and take the Latins by surprise. Because, see, they're in the city. They're all fighting on the plain. And so his mother gives him the idea, why don't you go take the city right now? Threatening sudden, ruinous assault. Following Turnus down the long front, he viewed the city from one vantage or another, and saw how quiet it lay, immune, untouched by the wild battle. Now in his mind's eye, afire, he saw a greater fight to come. He called his officers, Mnestheus, Sergestius, brave Serestus, and climbed a rise of ground round which the Trojan legion came together, crowding shields and spears held at the ready. Standing amid them on the mound, he said, so this is Aeneas' speech to his men, there will be no time lost in carrying out what I shall say now. Jupiter stands with us. Granted this change of action unforeseen, on that account let no man lag behind. Unless our enemies accept our yoke and promise to obey us, on this day I shall destroy their town, root of this war, soul of Latinus' kingdom. I shall bring their smoking rooftops level with the ground. Must I go on, awaiting Turnus's whim to face and fight me once again in battle, beaten already as he is? I think not. Countrymen, this town is head and heart of an unholy war. Bring out your firebrands. Make terms this time with a town in flames. On this he ended, vying with one another, high-hearted troops, formed up in echelon. Which means in order of rank. They form up in order of rank, echelon. A compact mass and headed for the walls. Now scaling ladders all at once appeared. Now spurting fires. One company rushed the gates and cut down the first guards they met. Another launched their missiles, darkening the sky. Aeneas himself, among the foremost, held his right hand up in the shadow of the walls, with shouted accusations of Latinus, calling the gods to witness that once more the fight was forced upon him, that Italians twice had turned his foes, that a second pact had now been broken. Line 795. Amid the townspeople, panic and discord grew. Some said the town should be unbarred, gates opened to the Dardans. These would hail to the walls the king themselves, or they would drag them to the walls the king himself. The rest ran to fetch arms and man the ramparts. What was it like? A long Homeric simile, line 800. As when a shepherd, tracking bees, has found their hive in tufa, he fills up the cleft with acrid smoke. Inside, roused in alarm, the bees clamor around their waxen quarters, buzzing loud and growing hot with rage as black and reeking puffs invade their homes, and deep with rocky dark their hum resounds while smoke goes up in the clear air. So to make bees calm, you fill the beehive with smoke, and it calms them down. So now they see all the smoke here. More trouble came now to weary Latins, a new grief that shocked the whole town to its heart. When Queen Amata from her window saw the enemy at hand, the walls besieged, flames flying to the roofs, she saw no soldiers drawn up against them, no Rutulians under Turnus's command, and thought, poor woman, her prince had been destroyed in the melee. So Queen Amata thinks that her son-in-law-to-be, she thinks he's dead. Her mind driven by this thunderclap, she cried that she had been the cause, the source of evil, and many such laments in her sad frenzy. Maddened now, line 820, wishing to die, she tore her crimson gown and knotted round a beam that noose that strangled her in hideous death. So Queen Amata commits suicide because she thinks Turnus is dead. When Latin women heard of this disaster, doubling their sorrow, Princess Lavinia first tore her flower-like hair and scored her cheeks. She scratches up her face. Then all the rest crowded about her, mad with horror and grief. The palace rang with wailing everywhere in the town. The black news ran, and hearts grew sick. Ripping his robe, Latinus fouled his snowy hair with dust and filth, stunned by his wife's death and the city's fall. Fighting his war meanwhile and far away at the edge of the battlefield, Turnus pursued a straggling few, but now more sluggishly, less and less joyous in his winning team. Faint outcries with dark overtones of terror came to him on the breeze. He cupped his ears and heard the sound of turmoil in the city, a joyless uproar. Line 840. So Turnus is now realizing, oh no, we're not fighting on the battlefield. They're burning down our city and I'm way out here. Sink, heart. What great loss has brought on this commotion? This wild cry born from the distant city on the wind. With this distraught, he took the reins and halted. Then his sister, that's Juturna, who seemed his charioteer, Meticus, driver of his Team and Carr bent toward him and protested, "Turnus, this way, for our pursuit of Trojans. Victory opened the way here first, and there are others able over there to defend their homes. Aeneas is attacking the Italians in pitched battle. Let us play our parts by massacring Teucrians. Your death toll and feats of war will be no less than his." So his sister's trying to keep him alive by fighting Trojans out here, not going back to the city. But Turnus answered, "Sister, yes, I knew you long since," so he recognized her, "when you spoiled the pact by guile and gave yourself to this war. Now again, you need not try to hide your divinity, but who has wished you sent down from Olympus to take this rough work on, to put a woman in war, that you should see the painful end of your unhappy brother, who sent you down here to see me die? What am I to do? What stroke of luck can guarantee my safety now?" Turnus realizes now, "Oh my goodness, you're down here to try and help me live, but it's against the will of the gods. I saw before my eyes, in calling on my name, Murranus downed great soul by a great wound, and none survives more dear to me. Poor Ufens died as though to avoid seeing my shame. The Trojans have his body and his gear, mine 870. But now destruction of our homes, the one thing lacking to my desperate case. Can I face that? Should I not give the lie to Drances?" That's the guy who hates him. "Should I not give the lie to Drances? Shall I turn tail? Will this land know the sight of Turnus on the run? To die? Is that so miserable? Heaven has gold grown cold, shades of the other underworld. Be friendly to me. As a pure spirit, guiltless of that shame, I shall go down among you, never unfit to join my great forefathers." So he's going to go back and fight and die. He's never going to run away. Line 880. Just as he finished, here came Sasses riding at a dead run amid the enemy, his mount foaming, his face torn by a wound, crying out, "Turnus!" as he rode, and then, "Turnus, our last chance rests with you. Be moved for your own people. Like a thunderbolt, Aeneas falls on us. He means to topple the citadels of Italy in ruin. Firebrands even now fly to the roofs. The Latins turn their faces toward you, turn their eyes to you. The king himself, Latinus, mutters in doubt, unsure whom to call sons, what alliance to turn to." So the king's just all in turmoil and isn't doing anything. "Worst of all, the queen who put such trust in you is gone, dead by her own hand, fleeing daylight in fear. Only Messapus and Atinas still maintain a fighting line before the gates, in close formation on both flanks. The enemy bristles with spearheads like a crop of steel, and yet you keep your chariot in play on this deserted meadow." It's like, this is not appropriate for you to be out here, Turnus. You should be where the fight is. Stunned and confused by one and another image of disaster, Turnus held stock still with a silent stare. In that one heart, great shame boiled up, and madness mixed with grief, and love goaded by fury, courage inwardly known. When by and by the darkness shadowing him broke and light came to his mind again, wildly he turned his burning eyes toward and from his car, gazed at the city. Look now, billowing flames went up from floor to floor, entwined about a defensive tower that he himself had built and braced, fitted with wheels and ramps. Ah, sister, see, fate overpowers us. No holding back now. We must follow where the god calls, or implacable fortune calls. My mind's made up on what remains to do, to meet Aeneas hand to hand, to bear all that may be of bitterness in death. You'll find no more unseemliness in me. Let me be mad enough for this mad act, I pray, before I die. He left his car in one swift leap upon the field, and coursed away from his sad sister. Then, amid the spear casts of the enemies, on the run, he broke through the attacking Trojan line. So what's it like as he's running back to battle? As when a crag, dislodged by wind, rolls down from a mountaintop, for either a storm of rain washed earth from under it, or time and age had undermined it, and it goes headlong, a mass ungovernable, bounding in its huge descent, sweeping along with it trees, herds, and men. So when a big rock gets dislodged and goes rolling down, so through the broken ranks to the city walls went Turnus in his rush. With blood spilled there, the ground was drenched, the air a swish with javelins cast, his hand held up to arrest the fighting. With a great shout he called, "Rutulians, hold! Put up your weapons, Latins! The outcome here, for good or ill, is mine. Better that single-handed in your stead. I pay for a broken truce and fight it out to a decision." Line 945. When Aeneas heard the name of Turnus, he forsook the walls, forsook the high point of the citadel, threw off all hindrance, cut all action short. In joy, clanging in arms, a fearsome thunder. Grand, so he's clanging all his stuff together. What was it like? Ground as Mount Athos or Mount Eryx, or old Father Apennine himself, when high oaks, forest, flush, flash, and roar, and into heaven he rears the crown of snow, so just like a big thunderstorm. Now, sure enough, Rutulians and Trojans and Italians all outdid each other, dropping combat, craning to see now those men on the ramparts, those at the battering ram low on the walls put down their shields. Even Latinus marveled, seeing two giant men of action, born in countries so far distant, come together, vowed to a decision by the sword. Once a space on the open ground was cleared, the combatants ran forward, hurling spears, line 965, at a distance first, then closing hand to hand. Their brazen shields and harness rang. The earth groaned under them, redoubling stroke on stroke. They fought with swords, and prowess merged with luck in the fighting of each. And what was it like? Line 970. It was like on Scylla's flank of mighty mountain, or Tabernus's height, when two bulls lower heads and horns and charge in deadly combat, herdsmen blanch and scatter, then cattle all stand mute, as heifers muse on a new forest land, whom the herds will follow, the contenders, compact of shocking force with lowered horns, gore one another, bathing necks and humps in sheets of sheaths of blood, and the whole woodland bellows. Just so, Turnus, Trojan Aeneas, and the hero Turnus, son of Daunus, battering shield on shield, fought with a din that filled the air of heaven. Jupiter held the two pans of a scale in balance and placed in each a destiny. So again, we have the scale of the fates and who's going to die, who's going to live. Doom for him whose weight would bring down death. Turnus, thinking himself secure, flashed out to his full height, blade lifted overhead, and struck. The Trojans and the anxious Latins raised a cry, both ranks of men on edge, but then the treacherous blade on impact broke and left the man undone, enraged, his one recourse in flight. Swifter than wind he fled and stared at the strange sword hilt in his hand, because his sword broke off. Disarmed now, legend tells that when he first stepped up behind his team for headlong combat, haste made him leave his father's blade behind and snatch that of his charioteer Metiscus. This for a long time had sufficed while he rode down the Trojan stranglers from behind, but now, encountering the armor forged by the god Vulcan that Aeneas is wearing, the mere mortal blade snapped into fragments like an icicle, and shattered bits shone on the yellow sand. Crazed by the loss, in search of open ground, Turnus ran, weaving circles at a loss this way and that, for the dense crowd of Trojans ringed in and shut him, and on one side a broad marsh, on the other high stone walls, made limits to his flight. So now he's unarmed and he can't get away. As for Aeneas, slowed though his knees were by the arrow wound that hampered him at times, cutting his speed, he pressed on hotly, matching stride for stride behind his shaken foe. So what's it like as Aeneas chases down Turnus? As when a staghound corners a stag, blocked by a stream or by alarm at a barrier of crimson feathers strung by beaters, then the dog assaults him with darting, barking runs, the stag in fear of nets and the high riverbank attempts to flee and flee again 1,000 ways, but backed with power, the Umbrian hound hangs on, muzzle agape. Now he has him, now, as though he had him, snaps eluded jaws and bites on empty air. Then he gives tongue on furious barking. Riverbanks and pools echo the din, reverberant to the sky. So just like when dogs are ringing in and getting a stag. As Turnus ran, he raged at Rutulians, calling their names, demanding his own sword. Aeneas countered, threatening instant death for any who came near. He terrified them, promising demolition of their city, and pressed the chase, despite his wound. 5 times they ran the circular tract, and 5 again re-ran it backward, this way and now that. They raced for no light garland of the games, but strove to win the life and blood of Turnus. Though this race is not for a laurel wreath, it's for the life of Turnus. Line 1036. Now on this field there happened to have stood an old wild olive, bitter-leaved, a tree sacred to Faunus, with a trunk revered by seamen long ago. Those who survived shipwreck or storm fixed votive offerings there and hung their garments to Laurentine's god. The Trojans, treating it like any other, had left a stump but lopped away the tree so they could fight on a clear field. The spear thrown by Aeneas had stuck in that tough stump where winging force had carried and held it. The Dardan bent to extract the weapon now and cast it at the man he could not catch, so he's going to try and pull the sword blade out of that tree trunk and throw it at Aeneas. At this, Turnus grew mad with fear. He said, "Faunus, have pity, I entreat you. Gracious earth, hold fast the steel, if I have honored you all my life, whereas Aeneas's men warred on you and profaned you." So he prayed and asked divine assistance, not in vain, for pausing at the stump and struggling long, Aeneas, using all his power, could not pry apart the bite of stubborn oak. As bitterly he braced and strove, Juturna ran up once again, changed to Metisius, giving her brother back his sword. At this, indignant, the nymph had made so free, Venus came forward. So Venus, Juturna and Venus are now helping their humans. Venus came forward, and she tore away Aeneas's weapon from the deep oak root. So Aeneas swung at Turnus and got stuck in the oak tree, and Turnus prayed, "Oh, please let it stick. Please hang on to it, hang on to it." And then Venus comes down and helps Aeneas pull his weapon out from the deep oak root. So both men were rearmed. They towered up, one confident in his own blade, the other tall and savage, with a spear to throw, and both now panting, faced the duel of Mars. Omnipotent Olympus's king, meanwhile, had words for Juno, line 1070. So Zeus is really mad at Juno. As she watched the combat out of a golden cloud, he said, "My consort, what will the end be? What is left for you? You yourself know, and say you know, Aeneas born for heaven, tutelary of this land, by fate to be translated to the stars. What do you plan? What are you hoping for? Keeping your seat apart in the cold clouds. Fitting, was it, that a mortal archer wound an immortal? That a blade let slip should be restored to Turnus, a new force, a crew to a beaten man? Without your help, what could Juturna do? Come now, at last have done, and heed our pleading, and give way. In other words, Turnus is going to die. Why don't you just quit trying?" Line 1085, "Let yourself no longer be consumed without relief by all that inward burning. Get over it. Let care and trouble not forever come to me from your sweet lips. The finish is at hand. You had the power to harry men of Troy by land and sea, to light the fire of war beyond belief, to scar a family with mounting, with mourning before marriage. I forbid you going further." So spoke Jupiter, and with a downcast look, Juno replied, "Because I knew that is your will indeed, great Jupiter, I left the earth below, though sore at heart, and left the side of Turnus. Were it not so, you would not see me here, suffering all that passes. Here alone, resting on air, I should be armed in flames at the very battle line, dragging the Trojans into a deadly action. I persuaded Juturna, I confess, to help her brother in this hard lot, and I approve her daring greater difficulties to save his life, but not that she should fight with bow and arrow. This I swear by Styx's great fountainhead, inexorable, which high gods hold in awe." So she swore. She's swearing by the Styx. "I yield now, and for all my hatred leave this battlefield. But one thing not retained by fate, I beg for Latium, for the future greatness of your kin, when presently they crown peace with a happy wedding day. So let it be, and merge their laws and treaties. Never command the land's own Latin folk to change their old name." So Juno says, "Okay, I'm asking one thing. Don't let the Trojans, when they win this war today, change the Latins to be called Trojans, but let them accept to be called Latins. To become new Trojans, known as Teucrians, never make them alter dialect or dress. Let there be Alban kings for generations, and let Italian valor be the strength of Rome. In after times, once and for all, Troy fell, and with her name, let her be fallen." So Juno doesn't want the name of Troy to be anymore. Let them take over Italy here, but don't let them be called by their old name and renaming it. And of course, this is Virgil's way of going along with what is historically accurate. The author of Men in the World replied with a half smile. So this is Zeus speaking. "Sister of Jupiter, indeed you are, and Saturn's other child, to feel such anger stormy in your breast. But come, no need, put down this fit of rage. I grant your wish. I yield, I'm won over willingly. Ausonian folk will keep their father's language and their way of life, and that being so, their name. The Teucrians will mingle and be submerged, incorporated. Rituals and observances of theirs I'll add, but make them Latin, one in speech. Of the race to come, mixed with Ausonian blood, will outdo men and gods in its devotion. You shall see, and no nation on earth will honor and worship you so faithfully." To all this, Juno nodded in assent, and, gladdened by his promise, changed her mind. Then she withdrew from sky and cloud. That done, the father, this is Zeus, set about a second plan, to take Juturna from her warring brother. Stories are told of twin fiends, called the Dirae, these are furies, whom with hell's Megara, that's a fury, deep night bore in one birth. She entwined lined their heads with coils of snakes and gave them wings to race the wind. Before Jove's throne, a step from the cool, cruel king, these twins attend him and give piercing fear to ill mankind when he who rules the gods deals out appalling death and pestilence, or war to terrify our wicked cities. Jove now dispatched one of these, swift from heaven, bidding her to be an omen to Juturna. Down she flew in a whirlwind borne to earth. What was it like? Just like an arrow driven through a cloud from a taut string, an arrow armed with gall of deadly poison shot by a Parthian or a Cretan, for a wound immedicable. Whizzing and foreseen, it goes through racing shadows. So the spawn of night went diving downward to the earth. On seeing Trojan troops drawn up in face of Turnus's army, she took on at once the shape of that small bird that perches late at night on tombs or desolate rooftops and troubles darkness with a gruesome song. Shrunk to that form, the fiend in Turnus's face went screeching, flitting to and fro, and beating with her wings against his shield. Unstrung by numbness, faint and strange, he felt his hackles rise, so she's undoing Turnus. His voice choke in his throat. As for Juturna, when she knew the wings, the shriek to be the fiend's, she tore her hair, despairing. Then she fell upon her cheeks with nails, upon her breast with clenched hands. Turnus, how can your sister help you now? What action is still open to me, soldierly though I have been? Can I by any skill hold daylight for you? Can I meet and turn this deathliness away? Now I withdraw, now leave this war. Indecent birds, I fear you. Spare me your terror. Whiplash of your wings, I recognize that ghostly sound and guess great-hearted Jupiter's high cruel commands. Returns for my virginity, are they? He gave me life eternal. To what end? Why has mortality been taken from me? So Juturna, Turnus's sister, Zeus took advantage of her and made her an immortal nymph in, you know, reparation, trying to make it up to her. And now she can't even save her brother. Why has mortality been taken from me? Why does she even have to be immortal? She'd rather die with her brother. Now, beyond question, I could put a term to all my pain and go with my poor brother into the darkness, his companion there, never to die. Will any brook of mine without you, brother, still be sweet to me? If only Earth's abyss were wide enough to take me downward, goddess though I am, to join the shades below. So she lamented, line 1200, then with a long sigh, covering up her head in her gray mantle, sank to the river's depth. So his sister Juturna goes right back down into the river. She has to leave the war. Aeneas moved against his enemy and shook his heavy pine tree spear. He called from his hot heart. So this is Aeneas. Rearmed now, why so slow? Why even now fall back? The contest here is not a race, but fighting to the death with spear and sword. Take on all shapes there are, summon up all your nerve and skill. Choose any footing, fly among the stars, or hide in caverned earth. And the other shook his head. So this is Turnus saying, I do not fear your taunting fury, arrogant prince. It is the gods I fear, and Jove my enemy. So the gods are my enemy. He said no more, but looked around him. Then he saw a stone, enormous, ancient, set up there to prevent landowners' quarrels. So it's a cornerstone to mark a boundary stone. Even a dozen picked men, such as the earth produces in our day, could barely lift and shoulder it. He swooped and wrenched it free in one hand, then rose up to his heroic height, ran a few steps, and tried to hurl the stone against his foe. But as he bent, and as he ran, and as he hefted, and propelled the weight, he did not know himself. His knees gave way. His blood ran cold and froze. The stone itself, tumbling through space, fell short and had no impact. What was that like when he tried to throw this big rock and it didn't work? Just as in dreams, when the night swoop of sleep weighs on our eyes, it seems we try in vain to keep on running, try with all our might, but in the midst of effort, faint and fail. Our tongue is powerless. Familiar strength will not hold up our body. Not a sound or word will come. Just like in a bad dream, you can't make any sound, you can't do anything. Just so with Turnus now. However bravely he made shift to fight, the immortal fiend blocked and frustrated him. Flurrying images passed through his mind. He gazed at the Rutulians and beyond them, gazed at the city, hesitant in dread. He trembled now before the poised spear shaft and saw no way to escape. He had no force with which to close or reach his foe, no chariot and no sign of the charioteer, his sister. At a dead loss he stood. Aeneas made his deadly spear flash in the sun and aimed it, line 1250, narrowing his eyes for a lucky hit. Then, distant still, he put his body's might into the cast. Never a stone that soared from a wall-battering catapult went humming loud as this, nor with so great a crack burst ever a bolt of lightning. It flew on like a black whirlwind, bringing devastation. Pierced with a crash the rim of sevenfold shield, cleared the cuirass's edge and passed clean through the middle of Turnus's thigh. Force of the blow brought the huge man to earth, his knees buckling, and a groan swept the Rutulians as they rose, a groan heard echoing on all sides from all the mountain rage and echoed by the forest. The man brought down, brought low, lifted his eyes and held his right hand out to make his plea. "This is Turnus. Clearly I earned this, and I ask no quarter. Make the most of your good fortune here. If you can feel a father's grief, and you too had such a father in Anchises, then let me bespeak your mercy for old age into honest, and return me, or my body, stripped, if you will, of life, to my own kin." So this is Turnus saying, "Please, you know, when you kill me, either let me live for my old father's sake, or at least give my body back to him. You've defeated me. The Ausonians have seen me in defeat. Spreading my hands, Lavinia is your bride, so I'm even giving her to you. But go no further out of hatred." Fierce under arms, Aeneas looked to and fro and towered, and stayed his hand upon the sword hilt. Moment by moment now, what Turnus said began to bring him around from indecision. So Aeneas is kind of thinking, "Well, maybe I won't kill you." Then to his glance appeared the accursed sword belt surmounting Turnus's shoulder, shining with its familiar studs, the strap young Pallas wore when Turnus wounded him and left him dead upon the field. Now Turnus bore that enemy token on his shoulder, enemy still, for when the sight came home to him, Aeneas raged at the relic of his anguish worn by this man as trophy. So when Aeneas sees Turnus wearing the armor of his good friend Pallas, it all comes back to him. "No, I'm going to kill this guy." Blazing up and terrible in his anger, he called out, "You and your plunder torn from one of mine, shall I be robbed of you? This wound will come from Pallas, so I'm going to kill you, but this is for Pallas' sake. Pallas makes this offering, and from your criminal blood exacts his due." He sank his blade in fury in Turnus' chest. Then all the body slackened in death's chill, and with a groan for that indignity, his spirit fled into the gloom below. The end.